This is channel one over. This is channel one over, and the tail end of the talk out here at the kitchen table with Jackie Arrowsmith. That Thursday, I think it was, in the week of May the 5th, she brought Professor Walt's piece that caused much attention from Harvard. He talked about responsibility these days, young people. Now she's telling her how she and Ron got together. They both had had enough schooling for a while.
Smithsonian books, everything, you know, I read these, and it's a beautiful reference library, fantastic reference library, and of course I just...
You just made a mistake getting married.
No. But...
There's a sacrifice.
No, it's funny. That Mr. Crane who hired me, the millionaire, when I told him I was quitting, he didn't believe it. He talked to me for 1 hour. He harangued, walked up and down, but he says, I hired you for life. I laughed, and he never cracked a smile. And I laughed like crazy. I thought that was the funniest thing I'd ever heard. He never cracked a smile, Mr. Crane. Poor man. God rest his soul. He died last December. And I just never thought he would. You know, he's robust, you know, and it was quite a shock.
That's the kind of thing.
They have fishing is their business, and... sponging. Now, this is my girlfriend, Jeannie. See why I went down there. I had finished a grant, a research grant at the University of Miami, in March, the 30th of March, 31st of March, I finished a grant, and Jeannie picked me up April the 1st. She came up from the Keys to Miami, and she picked me up, and I went down with her, and then I met Ronnie about a week after I was down there. But her dad was dying of cancer, and she had been his only nurse for 3 years in Chicago. See, they had this property down in the Keys, in Marathon, and... he had bought the property about 4 or 5 years before that because he loved the fishing. He just loved the fishing down there. And so he bought this land and then built, you know, a couple of duplexes on the property. And it was on a canal, you know, and everything in the ocean side. And I went down there with Jeannie, and her daddy was dying, and she was a mess from taking care of him, you know. And I was with her day and night, you know, sort of. And then I met Ronnie, and oh, he was so good. So the night that her dad died, Ronnie came by and he said to her mother, you know, Jeannie's mother and us, he says, I'll drive you to Miami International Airport tomorrow morning, the two of them, because they were in no way to drive, you know. So he drove them the next morning, 7 o'clock, to Miami International with her dad's body, you know, for the funeral back in Chicago. And when we were down there, Jeannie and I used to go off for a couple of hours or so to get away from things. To the beaches, the, you know, deserted beaches down in the different keys. And we'd meet fishing people, had their own fishing boat. They'd catch what they could and sell it. They'd catch crayfish and sell them. Then we met this man who had, he lived in an old broken down station wagon. And it was a mess, and he had outside his cooking utensils outside the station wagon, right at the edge of one of the beaches, you know. One of the keys, and he had this little old beat-up dinghy, little beat-up old dinghy, and he had it piled, and he had a place that was all piled with sponges. And we got to talking to him, and he was from Chicago area, Midwest or Ohio, one of those places. And he came down in the winter time, and he spent December and January and February doing nothing but sponging alone by himself. The boat, when he was finished, he'd attach his dinghy to the top of his station wagon. And he'd go out and he'd just go down with a knife or a machete, some kind of a knife he had, and he'd go down and cut the sponges from the various little islands off, you know, off the quay there, because there's all kind of little islands. He'd go out there with his rowboat to the quay. And we asked him about sharks, and he says, yes, and barracuda, they come around him. But he doesn't move. When they come in close, he doesn't move, and then they go away. And he says he's never bothered. And he'd been doing that for I don't know how many years, coming down, and that's what he did. And then he'd take them. So we asked him, how much do you get for each one of those sponges you take back when they're dried? 25 cents was he was getting then. And this was 6 years ago, 5 or 6 years ago. He was getting 25 cents a sponge. And here's an entrepreneur, and that's what he did. Collected his own sponges. He was all alone in that business. And we marveled at that, because we always spent about an hour talking to him, you know, what he ate and how he cooked and stuff, and if he liked it, and So he avoided, he got away with it.
And I said, let me play you a tape if you want a character like that. So I gave him the last one I made with Mike Weaver on the Spotted Horses.
That's the end of this little tape with Jackie Arrowsmith, that week of May the 5th, out at here at the kitchen table. This is about 57, Channel 1 over. Channel 1 over 57, the end of the tape with Jackie Arrowsmith out here at the ranch at the table that week of May the 5th. This is the second little talk with Suzanne Veltowitz in the office. Good long talk on the Trinity School address and the Quiet Lee. This was after the test on the Scarlet Letter. And I wanted to see how Emerson's own kind of inspiration entered her mind, along with the theological one that she has grown up with and developed. And she was right nervous today. In the first session, she was right bouncy, and her mind didn't work quite as well. Now, that was on, I don't know just what date it was, must have been Friday the 2nd of May, 69. It's on the same cassette as that marvelous little tape with Suzanne, when Suzanne has already seen the light. She got it through this article, Molly, that helped her the most, and she sees what Emerson is doing. Now, this is Saturday, 2 weeks later, and on Wednesday, I guess it was, Suzanne Veltowitz turned in to me this marvelous little paper on question one of that test on the Scarlet Letter. Dimmesdale's antics, you know, after the visit with Hester in the forest. His mind is cleared for the time being through Hester of the institution and is freed. And he wants to debunk the institution, but she can't face that. But that's another question. That's her paper. And yesterday, after the third session on Moby Dick, talked about Ahab yesterday, those two marvelous passages right in the middle, the quarterdeck, and then the chapter called Moby Dick. And that's really as far into Ahab as I ever wish to go. And I don't care to take Ishmael into Ahab's thought. I said to her, she left, that we were overdue another talk. And she said yes. She didn't know whether she could get free on Friday. I said, doesn't matter, next week. So we have something to look forward to. And this is a remarkable little paper that she wrote on that.
What am I doing in there? Why am I taking it?
What are you doing with Matthew?
We were just studying him, comparing him to Lawson, and then going back to...
Well, how does he compare?
Well, literarily speaking, he's more fluent, more flowing. He's he has a greater grasp of the subject matter. He expands a little more than Mark, especially. But then we just bring in the parallels that are contained in Matthew, the parables that aren't in the others, and make those comparisons.
And then he uses prophecy for that in that peculiar manner of his.
Yeah, he does with the second coming in the 24th chapter with all the various signs.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then his woes.
And that's, they're not sure, you see, that that's not an insertion.
At the end, the prophecy part?
Yeah, all those woes and things like that.
Well, it's an insertion, definitely. But from where, we don't know.
Corruption.
You see?
Well, corruption,
I don't know.
Okay.
See, I believe that all these were divinely inspired by God. And we're studying the different origins, that perhaps Mark was the one who formed his book first in about 70 A.D. or a little before, perhaps a little after, depending on how you interpret some of the verses in Mark. And then from that, Matthew derived the most of his sayings.
Yes.
And then also
yeah.
There was some type of a L tradition, an oral tradition that existed at that time, or else something written but which was later lost. And then he drew a few more things from that.
Mm-hmm.
So, but how can people ever surmise where and really know for sure where it came from? I think we're looking at it from such a distance. There are so many things in the passage of time that could have, that can now prevent us from knowing positively. So, I think it's almost a waste of time to wonder about.
Who's class is that?
Dr. Hyde.
I know her. I've never seen him. I've talked to him on the phone.
Yeah. Yeah, he's a tall fellow with red hair.
I wouldn't.
I think he's a Unitarian.
Oh.
Okay.
Well, let me tell you, how does Hester look to you now?
How does Hester look?
Yes, in the Amazonian light.
She's a person who has given herself over to the nature that lies within her. She has now developed this sense of freedom. She's been freed from the laws of the Puritans because she's only subservient to her own. And, well, then, of course, you can...
She's been pushed into it.
Yeah. Pushed into the position from which later she was freed.
Yeah. Now, the Hawthorne doesn't, there's no sustained view of what her thought is.
What Hester's thought?
Yeah.
No, there isn't.
I'm sorry about that.
I don't know. It gives us something to wonder about, to think about. If he gave us everything there, you know, there wouldn't be much value in it. It would just be a book that we have and we can draw a little from it. But this way we have to spend some time thinking about it, and then we'll gain something a little more.
Well, those critics in your book regard it as a sort of incomplete treatment on Hawthorne's part, but it's as much as his fiction allowed him to do. Fiction hadn't been developed to the point where he could really sustain it. That's the way they present it.
Yeah, right.
And what he would say about it, I don't know. I'd love to know. You see, he sustains that view of, don't you know? That's one of the questions I ask you of Dimmesdale as he returns to the village.
When he is freed, and then all these, that's the one I answered, and all these phantoms and weird ideas.
Yeah. Now, how do you interpret that, basically?
Immediately what comes to mind is somebody else's criticism. How they said that perhaps he had just been freed, and so, he had finally given himself over to escaping from this town, probably without confessing. It isn't specific. In other words, he's sinning again. And so now he's given himself over freely to allow the power of Satan to come in and fill him with these thoughts. Some critics said that.
Not in this book.
Yeah. Definitely, I read it. I'm trying to think who it was.
It's he's momentarily he's freed from the institution.
That's true. Yeah.
And it's a great relief to him, you see, and he has these heretical sorts of thoughts. And in most cases, apparently, Hawthorne would suggest, just in passing, you see, that the ways in which he confronts his parishioners are things that he now thinks aren't worth fooling with.
Could you repeat that?
I'm ashamed to repeat it. I don't know that well. I'm just momentarily, you see, with Hester's strength, he is freed from the institution.
Right.
Now Hawthorne interprets him basically as being tied to the institution.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
That is, his mind is never free.
Right.
As Hester's is. Well, now you've got to consider that, see.
Yeah.
Now you're looking at it in Emersonian light now.
Yeah, I can agree then that he of course has been freed from it momentarily. But then why doesn't it sustain him?
Well, I'll take it in as it comes.
Immediately after that, he rips up his election sermon as soon as he gets home.
Yes.
And immediately he casts out those thoughts then pertinent to, or else he tries to quell them with something else.
No, he doesn't cast out those thoughts. He casts out the what thoughts he had already put in the election sermon.
Yeah. Yeah, but then while he's thinking of the new election sermon, he must forget about all those phantoms.
Not necessarily. Now those phantoms may be real. Now you've got
hear the entire thing. We just heard the sounds, the rising majestically, and we just heard the effects of it. And there seemed to be this deep pathos continually running through it that really got into the hearts of the people. And I think Emerson really admired that, because Emerson said that, well, I think he mentioned once how that often people wish that they could express something as well as someone else, and when two hearts are perfectly in tune, it's wonderfully harmonious. But then you can take offense at that when you see that Dimmesdale's heart and Chillingsworth's, their intuition was almost in harmony, because as soon as one would sense that the other was getting a little too deep, the one who was doing the probing would sense that too. So they were in quite close contact.
Yes, with that pathos that he expresses in his words, that you hear in his words, as Hawthorne represents it, comes. He's a little bit more explicit in that now. He gives you a little of the source of the pathos. The New England could become what it was supposed to become. It could.
And what did he feel it was supposed to become?
You take that in an Emersonian sense.
Oh, a freer. Liberated.
Like Hester.
Yeah.
Who lived by the light. You see, I'm...
Look at... Yeah.
I'm depending on you a good bit now to sort of steer us through this. Now, you've got two trains of thought, you see. One is your institutional thought, and one is Emerson's non-institutional thought,
yeah.
And you've got to keep them clear.
Well, look at Hester. And we say that she is free. She's bound to her own nature. But then she's really not. Because... what can she do with herself? She had to leave. She couldn't stay there and be free and be herself.
That's not in the book.
She left at the end.
You don't.
She came back.
Yeah, that's not in the book, really.
No. Okay.
Hawthorne doesn't know that.
That's true. Very true. Yeah. And then he says that often the thought is enough. It suffices.
Yeah. And I see that helps.
But it's only expression of the thought that ultimately is beneficial or is of any value.
Emerson doesn't leave it at that. He says a thought and an act are on the same terms. Now that's in your essays. I've never worked that out quite.
Yeah.
And don't you know, in the Education of the Scholar, he follows that with the duties of the scholar.
Yes, right.
Now the question is, what are the duties of the scholar? I think that's one of your universals. I don't think there's an answer to that. Let me tell you, some of my neighbors are Jehovah's Witnesses. Most people are condescending towards them. I've sat in a number of their sessions, and I find them extremely interesting. One of the ladies is Leola Wicks, and she's elderly, and she's been doing this since 1930. And her mind is clear, and her voice is right sustained. She's right sustained, and I learned from her. the light. I say now they visit, you know, their method of going out and calling on people, and. The object of that, you've got the same choice. The object of that is to provide light. You can put it in religious terms, provide the word, or to influence conduct.
Right. Yeah.
They don't influence conduct. They take no hand in public affairs.
So.
At the same time, they have to face it that a study of the word affects the conduct.
Exactly, right.
But you see, you've got a relationship there that's almost inevitable, and you can't decide one way or the other. It's sort of universal.
Yeah, that's true.
So in Emerson, he faces it. And that little thing that duties of the scholar is to provide light. And to show men facts amidst appearances. That's a philosophical term, that is noumena among phenomena.
Yeah.
That's his, you know, that's his.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know. I just have a little glimmer of what he's talking about. I think he's, you see, he's gone so much further than I have.
Do you think he intended us to look at it through Emersonian eyes? I mean, we can look at it through anyone's eyes, but do you think that this is really the best way or not? That we can gain the most from it?
I think you have to go back to the first day of class when they talked about the scholar there and there, and it was utter nonsense.
Oh, what?
Utter nonsense.
Oh, yeah.
So what this does is bring some meaning into it.
Right. Right.
That's all. Not the last stage.
Yeah.
I'm ashamed to think about what part of the scholar letter means to people who've read it or even studied it. And that's...
I don't think most people, when they read a novel like that, take the time to really think about it.
Yeah.
Often you just would get the mere superficial little explanation that we did in class that day.
Yeah.
I'm sure that's generally true. Which is a pity, because when you really study it, it's different.
Yeah, but it's the material you're working with, I think, he can't handle it. I think it causes him his trouble. You see, Hester is not concerned with her sin.
Not at all.
And repentance, it's with something else. And still her portrait, and that portrait is unfinished.
Seems hard to understand that she's not really concerned with her sin. Because she can see and perhaps even sense that Dimmesdale is suffering himself. And how could you, knowing that your partner in sin is suffering like that, not feel repentant for something that you are not suffering for, but that you've helped cause him to suffer for?
Well, you have to take it the way it's presented, and she sees him going pieces on this pillar, on that scaffold.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So she embraces him. Where does she get the strength?
Yeah, but she didn't sense it before. Well, 3 years elapsed before she saw him in the garden. And surely in the garden, when she saw him tremulously, you know, clutching his heart, and then you don't think she would have suspected anything then? He must have gradually wasted away.
I don't believe Hawthorne's story stands to reason. I don't think he would rationalize it.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
He's using a fiction. I think the fiction he uses stands in his way. See, he separates them for several
seconds. Well, that's it. Isn't that exactly what Emerson says? That one cannot convey an eternal truth or something that's so pure in thought without getting some fiction in the way. He mentioned that. Yeah.
Well, Emerson goes from one metaphor to another, you know.
Yeah.
Actually, it's, you know, what he's doing is sort of Platonism, trying to make it specific. Let me tell you, you know, your thinking, your handling of these subjects, that comes from your training in science.
Probably, sure it does. Is that good or bad?
I don't think religious subjects ever train the mind.
You don't?
I've never seen it happen.
Well, I think I have. My dad has had no formal education beyond 8th grade. And yet he could read a story like that, and he has perception and insight into it. And I would say he's only derived that through the grace of God, through his study of the scriptures and his delving into human nature through his religious outlook.
He's had a great deal of experience.
Oh, that too. Coupled with that, definitely. Oh, yeah.
Now, you see, for a century or two, our education was religious education.
Yeah.
And I have worked closely with religious people in education. And what little experience I've had is that they don't really train the mind.
Yeah. See, too often, they can merely compare it with their religious beliefs or look at it from their viewpoint and
mm-hmm.
shut out everything else. So they don't study the other aspects of
yeah.
it. They erect this little barrier of prejudices
yeah.
maybe against the rest.
Yeah. I don't mean to say that they, you know, they weren't competent themselves.
Oh,
but
yeah,
they never,
right.
they never, I've never seen it. I've never seen it.
Mm-hmm.
I've never seen it done. But see, I've not seen much.
Yeah.
With what little I've seen, and I've been associated pretty much with it. I think that from what little I've seen, I think that that's the relationship. You see, what religion contributes to the personality is something entirely different. It's something that, you see, your sciences won't do. It won't refine the mind.
The religion?
Yes.
I don't know. Science doesn't exactly refine the mind either. To me, it strips it naked of any type of emotional or any type of psychological perception.
But you use your mind.
You do. That's right, you do. Well, look at Hawthorne himself. In order for him to express those things, he had obviously brooded over them, as it says there. He'd meditated
yeah.
on them for a long time. Was he a scientific man, reorientated or not?
No, but he could look at different points of view.
But he was deeply religiously orientated or not?
He's critical of it. He's critical of institutionalized religion.
Right.
That's about
yeah.
all one can see. But you see, I think Randall Stewart brings out the religious side better than anyone I've ever seen in handling Hawthorne. In that
yeah.
last scene there of Dimmesdale, and Randall Stewart talking.
Yeah, have mercy.
Yes.
Forgive me.
Yes.
Yeah.
You see?
Yeah, yeah.
But you see, that's just momentary.
Yeah.
That's almost using Emersonian skills to bring out religious illumination. You see, there's much there that I don't understand. I just, you know, sort of have glimpses of it. But, don't you know, I went into that little article of Spiller's with you. He doubted that Hawthorne experience meant much to him, and that his fiction was such that he could present the truth. Well, he has limitations, yes, but he makes it hard on the reader. I mean, the reader has to be pretty well advanced. Now, what I know, you see, I learned from talking to you all, and also from reading these articles. So I'm not, you know, especially a good reader.
You're most students, of course.
Well, let me tell you, Hawthorne can see it from both points of view. He can see it from the Emersonian view, and then the limitations of that. He can see the romantic side of it, and examine it, and then let it go. And I think I think that's the beauty of it. And then you see, you can do that too. You can kind of follow in that.
Right, yeah. Isn't that how Stuart approaches it almost?
Huh?
Isn't that what Stuart himself said? That
yeah. And you're not deciding between those viewpoints. You're just trying to isolate them.
Right. And actually, it's almost impossible to isolate them entirely and to take one or the other. It's almost a general merging of them both.
I'm not sure. Now, you see, if you talk to me, it'll help you a little bit. But I can't. You can go farther than I can in a good number of these things.
I don't know.
Or yes, you can. Let me tell you. Now, I would say the election sermon, really, is, you see, Emerson was an orator. And they listened, you see, is a spoken word that they responded to.
Yeah.
And I think really, what... Dimmesdale does, it is almost like an Emersonian poem. It's an illumination of an Emersonian sort. I don't think it's a religious theme, actually. From all we know about it, I don't think it's a religious theme. I think it's almost as if Hester, you see, had been able to pursue and hadn't been cut off.
Well, what would he have talked about? If it wasn't religious, it was some spiritual type.
He's talking about the same thing that, see, now we're swapping, you ask the question, pushing off on me, I'm supposed to ask you, what is the content, you see?
Yeah. Well, it was definitely something pertinent to one's innermost spirit.
He's talking about partly the future of New England.
Yeah.
And that's one's innermost spirit.
Yeah, right.
Like, and that's what Emerson talked about.
Yeah.
In the Divinity School address and in the Scholar.
Yeah, right.
Our day of national independence, dependence has come to an end.
Yeah.
And the direction we can go is in this Emersonian way.
Which is what Hawthorne seems to take up.
Pursuing the light.
Yeah.
And not letting society take over or institutions of any sort.
Wondering how you can get away from it. This, I mean, these authors try to get down to it and sort of exhort us to somehow cast it off so we can be a little more illuminated and free. But I don't think man can ever reach that point. Society will always have its boundaries, and to some degree they're necessary. Otherwise it would be nothing but a chaotic state.
You're not taken in by the limitations of an institution like this.
I'm taken in by it?
Yes. You mentally you see the shortcomings of this institution.
Yeah, right. But I'm still free to think for myself within it.
Yeah. That's right.
But not to act.
That's
if perhaps my thoughts would direct me.
Well, no.
Well, almost. You still are.
No, but you still are not bothered with the mechanics of the institutions and all that stuff, you see.
Yeah,
there's
Puritans where?
So that somewhere along the line, institutions. I don't think Emerson is saying, or could possibly say, you know, that institutions, we can live without institutions, or beyond them, above them, but not be overpowered by them.
Right.
And when we do something, just not do something stupid. And not institutionalize our thinking.
Oh, definitely.
Now, you see, I just read the little church bulletin, and they're going to have a fish fry from the Methodist Men's Club. Well, I don't need to go down to that. Have a fish fry.
You wouldn't?
Oh, I do sometimes. But I'm trying to think about the institutional side of it.
Yeah.
You know, I still think the most, I tell you, now this is my prejudice or limitation. I still think of the sermon is still the high point of a religious life or experience.
The giving or the hearing of it?
Well, either one. if you hear right, you know.
Right,
if you
really speak right too.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, because too often preachers arise and read off something.
Yeah. Well, now you see, that's my limitation. I don't feel that a good deed. See, I don't feel that a good deed takes the place of a perception.
I see. It doesn't. It's merely a substitute for it. Perhaps the person cannot actually perceive it, so he does this in order to vindicate his own feeling for it.
I don't have much interest in the moral life. Just to give somebody something because he's hungry.
Why would you give it to him then?
Well, I mean, I wouldn't particularly value that. I mean, I'd just put that on the level of a civic virtue.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah, I agree.
Oh, don't agree with me. I don't know all those things. You know, there's much in this I don't understand. I just half-baked. But I tell you what. Now, you see, we're just starting in it. That's why I wanted to make this little test a little bit more important than the others. It'll make you, you know, dig a little bit. And then, see, we'll work on this from time to time.
Yeah.
So.
See, it's rarely that I actually have ever stopped to think like this. It's really good. It's something I've always wanted to do. But with these, well, not even taking courses like this, it's been impossible. So I really enjoy
right.
it. I'm very, very eager to do it.
You know, I don't know where I'd talk sense if I didn't, you know, have these little courses. Every now and then, you see, we talk sense, you know. And everywhere else I go, we don't.
Oh, now. You mentioned that in class one day, and I thought, boy, I'm glad your wife didn't hear it.
Yeah.
Dr. Miles, I think I ought to go. I have to go to work. What time is it now?
Yeah, what time?
Yes,
I enjoyed the talk.
Oh, I better. Poor Dr. Griffin. Begin to wonder if I'm even coming. Okay, well, I did enjoy it too. So we'll see.
Well, that's the end of that delightful tape, that delightful session. I didn't realize how we should have cut it short about halfway through. We said those things over and over again. And I thought Suzanne stood her ground right well. She went, I labored a little bit. But her position is remarkable, just remarkable. Though she doesn't want to fly on ever since the wings, not yet, and it's perfectly all right. That's the end. That's about 5:460, channel one over, on this Emerson reel. Suzanne Veltwist on that Friday after the big test on the Scarlet Letter, I think it was, 2nd of May, 69. And this is 4:60, channel one over. This is an old tape. It's a discussion of Paul Richard in Walden, in the first part of Walden that he calls economy. I don't know the date. I'm just clearing up these old cassettes. And this is Saturday, the 17th of May, 69. This is about 4:70, channel one over. 4:70, channel one over. And this is an old cassette, and it has a general discussion in class of Paul Richard in economy, the first part of Walden.
Good morning. I'm going to be too serious-minded. But you know, about 5 or 10 minutes on this side, a paragraph, you might say, of Thoreau is a kind of tonic. Now, one of the finest office mates I ever had, the first thing he did of the morning was open up the Tampa paper and just concentrate on it for 15 minutes. So, I can't be too critical, you see. Let me remind. I'll ask you a question too about Walter now. Let me remind you. I want you to keep poor Richard in mind. I don't know whether we have become acquainted with Franklin or not in our reading, or just the autobiography. And I want to hear you say from time to time. I don't want you to make up your mind, but I want you, you know, to keep that in your mind. This is the one volume biography. You see, any biography of Franklin will have to be rather long. He lived so, he lived so long, and everything he did was interesting. Now, this is at Passy, and this is after the Revolution or during, and I forget this one. His sober, unembroidered brown coat with a fur collar in cold weather became almost his uniform. He carried his crabtree stick wherever he went and always wore glasses. And then he talks about his glasses. And his permanent household was himself, Temple Franklin, and his French clerk. Benjamin Bach, until he was sent to Geneva, lived at his school in Passy with John Quincy Adams for a year or so and other American boys from time to time. Franklin's closest friends in France were, for the most part, his nearest neighbors. He was on good terms with the parish priest and the village tradesman. He and the Chaumont family in the hotel something saw each other almost daily. Franklin teasingly called the daughter Sophie, his wife, which delighted her. Passy was then famous for its mineral springs down the slope near the river, and Louis, somebody who managed the drinking, bottling, and bathing at the Ole, and became in 1789 the first mayor of the town, lived there, like Franklin, all the year round. And he and his wife and daughters were Franklin's friends for life. And Franklin, John Adams disapprovingly said, at the age of 70-odd, had neither lost his love of beauty nor his taste for it. But there's no support for the tradition that he indulged himself in this age. And he talks about the Franklin. This is quoted from his letters. He says, I must explain this matter. This is the civilest nation on earth. Your first acquaintances endeavor to find out what you like, and they tell others. If it's understood that you like mutton, dine where you will, you'll have mutton. Now, some of the attentions paid him were in the elaborate Arcadian mode of the old regime, which was so near its downfall. Madame Campan, companion of Marie Antoinette, later remembered a ceremonial occasion when the most beautiful of 300 women placed a crown of laurel on Franklin's white head and kissed both his cheeks. In April 1781, he was the hero of a country festival arranged by the Countess, the Sophie of Rousseau's Confessions, at her house in Sainois, 10 miles from Passy. She and her party came on foot half a mile to meet his carriage, and she welcomed him with verses she had composed herself. Liberty, the verses sighed, was far off, but here was a mortal who had made happy citizens. Hosts and guests walked to the chateau and dinner. At each glass of wine, there was another stanza to be sung or spoken. There would be altars in America for Benjamin, the chorus said, and let Sanoa drink to his renown. He freed men by enlightening them, said the one stanza, and virtue took its very countenance from him. William Tell was brave but savage. Our dear Benjamin, shaping his destiny of America, could laugh at this civilized table. Long live Philadelphia, sang the countess. Its independence so tempted her that she would like to live there, though it had no balls or comedies. Now, that's the very peak of civilization at that time, and Franklin is its darling. And he thinks in those terms. That's not in the autobiography. I just picked up that one passage. I don't know whether I got a good one or not. You can look through it whenever you get around to it. You want to say a word about Franklin? Well, I hate to leave Franklin. Let's start with Walden then. Yes, ma'am. Ma'am. What do you want to say first? Yes. Now he talks about himself. What'd you say? Now you all talk a little bit. Yes, ma'am. You think Thoreau is the opposite of Franklin. He talks about ideas, not his own accomplishments. More so. Well, let's pick that up. Take it yay or nay. You don't care. You know what you want to do is get into it. Now, see, if I take the reverse, I don't mean to take, you know, be opposed to it. I'm just getting into it. So. Yes. Yes. Now, Thoreau, Franklin, as a tradesman, that's a poor Richard, ideal tradesman, wanted to appear businesslike and industrious and whatever you said, as well as be those things. Now, what do you say about Thoreau?
Well, Thoreau said that a man shouldn't put his value on clothes. He should, clothes just for, you know, fashion. And Franklin said,
well, now, this is an awfully good beginning. I like that. I like that. Yes. That's right, different, isn't it? Yes.
I think
just be sure that I follow you. Franklin would go into business.
But his business inhibited him from doing what he wanted to do. He had to do business at other times. He was real late at night. And Thoreau had time to do it during the day.
And Thoreau wouldn't go into business because it prevented him from doing what he wanted to do. And Franklin had to do it at odd times and eventually get out of business. Well, now, that's right interesting. You've got two ways of life. Two ways. Yes. Now, let me see. I've got to be a little bit more Karen Kitty and Kathy Dittmar. Halsey? Well, now you might as well just go ahead. All I need to do now, the way you're all talking, is just be your moderator. I think you're getting into them right fast. You could see the visible benefits of Franklin's way of doing. He produces something as a printer and as, for his interest in the town, you see improvements. And for role, it looks like. He wants independence, but no, but he's all that comes out of it. He talks about other people, but he's sarcastic about it. Yes. Yes. Well, now that's going a little farther. Thoreau thought the best way to improve the town was to get out of town. You might say, and sort of abandon it. Well, now, yes, ma'am. Yes, you have a feeling that Franklin made friends just all the time during his life, was always making friends. And Thoreau, you're a little doubtful about it, aren't you? Even whether he wanted to make any friends or not. Midday. You see more in Franklin, more direct in the direction of conformity, of doing what is needed. And even that essay on moral perfection, I'm not sure that I would look at it precisely that way. Yes. Now this is, thinking about the individual himself and self-improvement, but this is for the individual to also improve the community. It works in that direction. Yes, I think so. Yeah. Think of Thoreau as the country boy. Yeah. And less community-minded, you might say. And Franklin is more of the, I think so, the city or the townsman. You see Franklin's friends in the autobiography. Would that be in the Junto? No, not, I believe so. Philosophical society. They read papers on once a month or some other, read books and talking to them. But now it was something else too. Pushing that, I don't know. I think that's a clear-cut case of being a business club too. I think it's three or four things. Where Franklin's friends would be useful to him.
Yeah.
Well, he'd be useful to them. I know what you mean. I don't want him, but maybe yeah, that's enough. I think that's clear. Yeah. But it's, but now, and you don't have anything like that in Thoreau. Yes, ma'am. No, that's, I've wondered that same thing. If Thoreau makes so much of it, why don't he just stay there? Well, now, you know it's rather dangerous to restate what a person just said. And now don't let me restate it wrong, will you? Maybe I will let you pick it up. I think anyone would say that Franklin is a public citizen, a public-spirited citizen. But I don't know that anyone would say Thoreau is. But what you're saying is that Thoreau is too. He's also public-spirited.
No, I'm not classifying him as a citizen, but as an individual.
But he's public-spirited.
What?
He's also public-spirited. Think I'm on the point of being idealistic. Thoreau is more idealistic.
I think he is, but I don't know, whereas in Franklin's philosophy, he's all
Franklin's improvements would go all the way from himself to streets and the street lighting to even the Constitution. Now, that's not in here, but he was in the Constitutional Convention, and when the colonists couldn't agree, Franklin said maybe the one thing they could do is just pray over it. And it looked for a long time as if they could never agree. Now, that's one of his improvements or contributions, too. So you've got a great range of that seems basic in them. Franklin's economy would lead towards becoming established in the world and gaining possessions, property. And Thoreau's attitude towards property was that it was a handicap, was a hindrance. Did I state the point? Yeah. No, I don't believe I could disagree with that. What would you say about that? Franklin was definitely writing and set an example, so that his children and other people, you know, learn from his experiences. And Thoreau would differ. He is not as wide an audience, you suppose? Whether, yes, ma'am. Read this passage. I think your discussion has been first rate. Let's just take a few passages. This is on the second page. I would fain say something. Isn't that on the second page? Not so much concerning the Chinese and Sandwich Islanders as you who read these pages, who are said to live in New England. Something about your condition, especially your outward condition of circumstances in this world, in this town, what it is, whether it is necessary that it be as bad as it is, whether it cannot be improved as well as not. He doesn't limit his audience here. I have traveled a good deal in Concord. I never know why he says that. Why does he say that? I've traveled a good deal in Concord. Like I say, I have traveled a good deal in Alachua County. I used to live up on the North County line. Now I live out on the South County line. That's about the extent of my...
Ordinary.
Now, why would he say this? I don't know why he puts in things like that. Yeah. I don't know. It's just a little country town. It looks in a way like what he's saying is that he has been all around Concord, and not all of the people have. But even that, you know, I think I have a feeling that in that time, most people knew all about Concord who lived there. Yeah.
I think he is.
He's not proposing a way of life, is he? But he is exposing theirs. And everywhere, in shops, offices, and fields, the inhabitants have appeared to me to be doing penance in a thousand different ways. What I've heard of the Brahmins, you know, doing penance in their thousand different ways, he thinks is nothing compared to what his countrymen do as he sees them around Concord doing penance. But they think they're living a fine life. It's very evident that what mean and sneaking lives many of you live.
I think he's trying to let you know that he's...
class of men live lives of quiet desperation. What is called resignation is confirmed desperation. I see it's a woman here. You're going to have trouble. I'm trying to find out now, what does he do first? He talks, this is economy. Most of the luxuries and many of the so-called comforts of life are not only not indispensable, but positive hindrances, you know. With respect to luxury and comforts, the wisest have ever lived a more simple and meager life. Now, you know, that was actually a part of Franklin's way of life. Not as a merchant, you see, but as a member of this 18th century of the Enlightenment. It was close to this, too. And even there at Passy, you know, they were practicing a sort of economy and pastoral simplicity. That was their purpose. They thought they were doing that to some extent. Now, there's his audience. He speaks to the mass of men who are discontented. I'm just taking his word for it, you know. Now he offers to say how he has spent his time. Now that's a sort of background that goes into why he goes to Walden. But I find that section not satisfactory. It'd be a good deal better to read Van Doren's account of that. He can reconstruct it and puts it in a direct way. And here Thoreau is a little bit on the playful side, as I remember. Now, he says at one place here, you see, my purpose in going to Walden was not to live cheaply, but to transact some private business. And then he has a rather interesting statement. I have always endeavored to acquire strict business habits. Now, there it looks as if he meets Franklin's on his own ground. They are indispensable to everything. If you trade with his Leicester Empire, he has a long passage here on trading. He didn't have order, don't you remember? You have to assume now that Thoreau is well acquainted with Franklin. He has absorbed Franklin. He's lived with him. He knows him better than we do. He's lived with him. See, not just read him. Go ahead.
This is the end of Channel 1 over. And this old tape, I don't know the date, a general discussion of Poor Richard in Walden, the first part on economy, and this is Channel 1 over, the end of Channel 1 over, and I don't know the date. I'm transferring the tape in May '69.